The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsigned Methods with me, Lachlan Bloom.
And me, Jamie Batchin.
And also, Happy New Year. Welcome to 2023.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Welcome to everyone. If this is your first time listening, it's a podcast where we speak to other writers of innovative fiction about their craft, approach, and technique. We have just hit the fifth anniversary of the first ever episode of Unsigned Methods. So there are 50-something episodes for you to go back and explore. And if you explore them and you like them, please like and subscribe wherever you find us. And if you're a long-time listener, thanks to everyone who's been on the journey with us.
Yeah, it's crazy thinking back at the conversations we've had over the last 5 years and where it's led us. I don't think either of us would have expected some of the conversations when we started out.
Certainly not. And thank you to all the writers and publishers particularly, who have helped support us on the way. We have covered some very interesting and unexpected ground on the way to January 2023, and hopefully there is much, much more to come.
Yeah. And moving on to new ground, still finding new and innovative novels and ways of writing. This month, we're speaking to not one author, but two authors who've collaborated. They're both academics, and they've sort of combined their respective academic expertise to create a novel called Macbeth.
Yeah, that's right. This month's guests are Ewan Ferney, who's an academic at the University of Birmingham, and Simon Palfrey, who's at Oxford, Shakespeare scholars who are looking for ways to work together on what I guess we would call experimental literary criticism, and producing a work of fiction out of that. Really sort of digging into Macbeth and the themes involved in that work.
I think they both seem to have a desire to kind of capture the sort of visceral element of Macbeth the play, which they felt was lacking in a lot of the literary criticism, which I think a valid point, that a lot of academic literary criticism can be on the tad dry side. So they set out to write a novel together, which sounds quite a lot of challenges along the way, but from the conversation, it seems they kind of hit it off from day one and seem to find a working method relatively easily.
I mean, it's interesting that we planned this interview quite a while ago. It's interesting that collaborative fiction is so hot right now, with Diego Garcia winning the Goldsmiths Prize at the end of last year, another collaboratively written novel. So I think it's really interesting to talk to two writers about how they go about the process. We've got a particular perspective from Ewan and Simon, in that they are people who are used to writing academic work and producing academic writing, about how they worked in this discipline. I think it was a really fascinating chat to hear how they worked together and how this book came into being.
Yeah, indeed. Without any further ado, we give you Simon Palfrey and Ewan Ferney.
We're speaking to you, I think, as the first pair of authors that we've had who've worked on the same book together. So I think there's going to be a lot of questions that we have around that. But I guess if we could just sort of start off asking you both a bit individually about your route to this book and what your sort of backgrounds are, for the benefit of our listeners.
Yeah, the route to this book was, it emerged out of, I mean, Ewan and I were a sort of developing a friendship, and part of that friendship was kind of galvanized by a shared frustration with literary criticism, the way in which things were written about, a sort of conformity and predictable modes of, you know, predictable historicism, predictable kinds of sort of pseudo theory. And we were a bit bored by that. And we wanted something which had more energy and more responded to the experience of reading, I suppose. And we were both in early mid-career, I guess, both a bit angsty and restless. The work on Macbeth, well, it developed in tandem with a series we were developing, because we created a series called Shakespeare Now, which was with Continuum, which was just trying to get more exciting Shakespeare criticism, really. Yeah, we used to talk about, you know, getting stuff which has still got the sort of the heat of the thought, or the heat of the mind in it, short books. And we thought about ways of doing that. And we had this idea of Who Kills Duncan and trying to get inside the murder chamber, because in the play, that doesn't actually happen. And we struggled for ages to try and find a form which didn't make us feel kind of ill. It was so kind of fake and awkward. And it sort of came upon fiction. So that was the origin of it. A slight sense of maverick restlessness.
Did you have any sort of attempts at other forms of fiction? The book's in prose, but I'd guess an obvious first step would be in the play format, to explore a play. I don't know, was that something you ruled out? Was that something you explored?
It's a good question. I mean, we did talk about a play, but that was a bit post hoc, I think, for various reasons. It's also true that there was a sort of humiliating ghost of a play that preceded the book we did write, because as Simon had said, one of the things we wanted to do was quite simply just to reveal and embody a really intense experience of reading in this case of this particular play, and we were trying to get into the vein of that, really. And we did at one point we talked about various other writers, not literary critics, who seemed to us to offer a route in, and Dostoevsky was one of them, and his influence survives in the structure of the final book. But we were thinking of a whole series of philosophers and religious figures and painters and so on, sort of in the delirious condition of the friendship Simon has described, in the sense that we were just going to set aside traditional literary criticism. We did try all sorts of peculiar things. And one of them was a sort of platonic dialogue between all sorts of unlikely figures. So, you know, like Dostoevsky and so on, too many men, but nevertheless. And so we did try that a bit, and it really didn't work. I mean, it was a sort of it just read as terribly pretentious. I don't think it was as pretentious as it sounds, because we were just thinking, what have we got that can help us closer in? But then we did, Simon in particular, I think, as we worked on it, did think, well, maybe there's a play in this or a film in this. Or on the other hand, I think it's probably true to say that we, because there was a sort of return of the repressed in it, really, of professional literary critics who suddenly thought, well, no, we really want to reveal what Macbeth is and what it's like to experience Macbeth, and to reveal that as something other than, you know, just sort of saying you've read it on the one hand, or producing an essay on the other. And it seemed to us that a kind of order of experience is there that's almost never really tapped, and yet it's so basic. It's passionate reading. It's the reason that people who discover reading fall for it and continue to do it. So we really wanted to do that. And our backgrounds, I think I can speak for Simon, we didn't come from families that went to the theatre. We discovered reading through paperback.
I think also with the play thing was always there. I mean, obviously you've got the kind of daunting example of Shakespeare's play, and you think, Christ, you know, and David Gregg did it with Dunsinane, which came out, you know, when we were working. And there were simple logistical reasons in my case for not doing a play, because it just requires too many other people. To get it produced is extraordinarily difficult, time-consuming, and costs money and so forth. And this seemed truer to our little kind of thing we did together, which we just kind of bash it out and had a kind of private intensity. I mean, I've subsequently done theatre work, but at that time, I think it was just this was truer to the spirit of our collaboration.
Both of you, your sort of careers are built in academia. I imagine you're there for spending most of your time prior to Macbeth working in the sort of literary criticism. Most of your writing would have been, in your day job at least, literary criticism. Were you both writing fiction as well, and outside of your day job, or in your day job in any way? Or was that something sort of new that you came to in some way? Or what's your history with fiction writing?
I mean, I spent quite a lot of time writing a novel called The Tasmanian Mercury, which has never been published, which I did in between doing my doctorate and starting a job. And I didn't really want to become an academic. I got an actual academic job because my wife got pregnant, and I was unemployed, and we just left Australia for England, and that's actually true. And I thought I'd better get a job. And so it was sort of accidental. And so, yeah, so fiction was there. And then I put on a different hat for a few years. It was always there as a sort of thing you're trying to do.
It felt quite natural to move into writing a piece of prose.
For me, it did. Because I think that a lot of my method of writing criticism was very voice-based anyway. It was rooted in my sensibility and my thoughts and my prose as opposed to actually doing any research.
I fiddled about as well for many years and you know, dreamed of literary glory and so on, but then done academic criticism. And I mean, I think what Simon says is true, and is true of me as well, except that I'd say that I think both of us also committed to literary criticism with the kind of imagination that we then wanted to bring to the book. And we did haver between those two poles, really, even as we wrote it, and we returned to it and think maybe we should kind of denature it a bit more as fiction, or we think no, we want it to be fully fledged fiction. And I mean, I think to this day, when we discuss it, there's a sense that we were trying to do two things, both increasingly, you know, as we worked on it, it gathered its own almost moral imperatives, where we felt to do justice to the story and the characters and so forth, we needed to give it more body and more plausibility and those sorts of things that I suppose writers of fiction often feel. But we also did feel that a sort of separate fidelity, really, to it as an act of criticism, where criticism seems the wrong word almost, but as of literary responsiveness that would give body to just to the experience of reading, which we felt was so, was the premise on which the whole conversation, the traditional conversation of literary criticism, and you know, that's in every school and in every, you know, university English course, was upon which it was based, and yet was somehow beside the point. So that was a strong imperative for us as well, I think.
Do you feel that your backgrounds working in the sort of academic realm helped with the collaborative nature of it? Because I appreciate that working on research projects and papers and things means that you are necessarily working with other writers. Do you think that helped lead to your decision to work together on this in this way?
It helped in the sense of that we had it. We met at a, did we? Yeah, we did. We met at a conference.
Yeah,
where, you know, Ewan was chairing this thing and was treated badly, I thought, and we just kind of, I, you know, by a bunch of idiots and kind of stuck up fools, kind of, and that sort of rebarbative, sort of jealous environment that the academic world often has, and I think we established an instant sort of solidarity and friendship. So in that sense, yes, and we met through that. But I actually think that our way of working together on this book was completely contrary to most academic collaboration. I mean, I've done a number of other collaborative works, and none of them resemble what Ewan and I did. In the usually there's a much more of a demarcation of responsibilities, which is expresses particular skills or expertise you have. So somebody's a theatre historian, so I've done a book on Shakespeare in Parts with Tiffany Stern, who's a fantastic theatre historian. So she had all this expertise that I didn't have. She brought that. I had my expertise in reading and theorising and thinking. We came together like that and sort of wrote separately. Whereas, and that's usually the way, you don't collaborate from a form of sort of emotional or temperamental reciprocity or sharedness, which is what Ewan and I did. So Ewan and I's was, it was really an expression of that kind of friendship. So, and it was, you know, it was born out of laughter and enjoyment more than anything. And I don't think much academic work you can say that.
No. I mean, the other thing, it was, I mean, in terms of, you know, sort of the economics of it, really, it was completely mad. I mean, we invested enormous amounts of time in it at every level. You know, we really did want almost every word to be co-owned, and we didn't leave any of it just exclusively to the other. And that was the great pleasure of it, and the great sort of learning that there was in it. And to that extent, it really is a child of a really thorough collaborative effort. And but in terms of, you know, far from being half the work, it was infinitely more, but then it was a great experience, a great thing to do, and it, for me at least, it has a kind of subjectivity and objectivity that it perhaps wouldn't have otherwise had.
Going back to the sort of impetus, and you obviously struck a deep friendship when you first met, and mulling over the sort of ideas around literary criticism and reading in general. Was there a point where you sort of struck on Macbeth, particularly in this project, particularly where you had a sort of aha moment, we can work together on this? I don't know your backgrounds exactly, but I understand you've not sort of been working purely on Macbeth. So what sort of made Macbeth jump out at you? And yeah, was there a sort of instant when the project coalesced into a real idea that seemed tangibly something possible that you could both work on?
I think we, as I said, we initially proposed this as a short, more or less critical book, which was endeavouring to get inside the murder chamber, as I said before, a short 30,000 word book. And I think we just, you know, we just talked about various things. And I'd done some work on Macbeth, and Ewan had written about shame and so forth. I don't even remember why, or a moment when we came upon Macbeth. It was just something which we thought could be interesting. And I think there was one of the things that was clear about Macbeth was that it really hadn't been touched. There was some sense in which the play pretty much completely escaped the methods that were all the rage in literary criticism, you know, the particular forms of historicism, new historicism, different forms of, it didn't, Macbeth just escaped it. It couldn't be kind of colonized by these methods. There was that, and the sense of the play's existential claim upon us felt untouched by these methods. So that was one of the reasons why. I mean, it could have been lots of other things, but that was the reason, I think, that we came upon Macbeth. I mean, the eureka moment wasn't so much Macbeth, was when the eureka moment, such as it was moving away, was you said before about how we had those, you know, awful, you know, sort of stilted Socratic dialogues and so forth, and just struggling for a form which didn't sound unbearably pretentious and sort of self-combing. And when we were in my office in Brasenose in Oxford, and we just, and I can't remember which of us had the thought, probably we had it simultaneously, but the idea of structuring something using Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov as a structuring model, you know, the murder of a father figure in the center, and the sense is four suspects, and every one of those suspects might be a version of Macbeth. And that was just it sort of came very, very quickly as an idea. And we liked that.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Was a sudden moment of clarity. I mean, the only thing I'd add to what Simon said is that I think the sort of obscenity of Macbeth was also something that became irresistible, really. And I do think Macbeth was sort of there all the time, like a kind of third thing or collaborator. And what I mean by obscenity was that we were aware that it's a naive point really, but just that Macbeth, you know, he's a murderer, he's a craven murderer, and yet so much of the play is invested in him, so much of the play's humanity resides in him. And I remember us talking, Simon, about leaning into the murder. That was a phrase, that verb seemed, you know, we felt, and perhaps we were wrong, but we felt that must be part of the, there must be something, you know, the common experience of Macbeth, that you're not with Duncan, or if you are, it's a kind of secondary effect.
Just remembered, Ewan, that the reason why I did Macbeth, because my experience of acting, when I was co-directing and acting in Macbeth when I was still in Australia, and I didn't want to act, and I had to play Duncan, and I started to speak the role of Duncan, and I thought, fuck off, this is just about the worst role anyone, and it was written in such a way that all you can do is hate yourself and want to go away, and in the sense that this guy has to be killed.
We did feel that.
Everything he speaks kind of curdles on your tongue. It's amazingly written, so that everything is fake. Everything he says is fake.
And impossible as well, isn't it?
Impossible, and just desperately. That was a real genuine emotion, and the fact that the play is written that requires his removal, it just
that requirement, which again we felt was sort of unspeakable, but sort of morally unspeakable, but certainly professionally unspeakable. And as Simon said, that sense that the play is built around a kind of weird transaction in the bedroom, really, which is never revealed and which is sort of wanted and so forth. So I think we felt that there was something, there's a terrible temptation, you know, funnily enough, in Macbeth that we felt compelled to investigate. And another thing we talked about at the time was that collaboration could help that, because literary criticism you know, it's a very moralizing form, really. You know, you take moral responsibility, you speak with your name, really, as a literary critic. And Simon said we were kind of just sort of about established, and there's an incredible freedom in saying, well, actually, we won't write as Simon Palfrey, who's written on this and that and might write on the next thing, but we'll write in some third space between ourselves, which just allows us a kind of ethical freedom, and which I hope wasn't just a sort of silly midlife kind of release, but actually was a freedom to explore the issues from all angles, really.
So, yeah, I mean, but that's in a sense the answer to the previous question about drama, because it's a dramatic liberty that you're not identified necessarily with any voice. You can split thoughts off multiply and own everything and nothing.
And on a practical point, once you'd sort of hit on the broad topic and it sounded like you were both on the same page in terms of what you were wanting to achieve from the start. How did you proceed practically? Did you both sort of go away and write 10,000 words and then reconvene to compare notes, or were you fleshing out a schema based on Brothers Karamazov and sending emails back and forth, or were you in daily phone calls? What were the sort of first practical steps to tentatively find a way to work together?
It developed over the time. I mean, it was a bit uneven at the start because, I mean, Ewan was on sabbatical and I wasn't. And so Ewan had these and he was obsessed with Cormac McCarthy at the time. And he produced his Cormac McCarthy pastiche at great length, which I would receive. And that was a bit, I just say, yeah, this is interesting. And, not, you know, tiny little bits that survive. But once we got into the swing of it, it was very much what you just said, all those things where you do almost daily phone calls a number of times a week. And we just riff it. We didn't really have a clear sense of how it would necessarily.
It was an adventure in that.
Yeah, it was just an adventure and lots of phone calls. And we would write bits and send it to the other one, and the other person would write into it or not. Sometimes just say, yeah, this is great. At other times, cut it, add to it, shape it, you know, back and forth. It was just like that. You know.
You didn't have any master sort of schema or anything that you were working from?
No, that's really big things.
Yeah.
Because we did it over a number of years, actually, because we had a first effort at it when it was very long, and then we had a couple of near misses with publishers, and then for one reason or another didn't happen, and then other projects took over, and then we returned to it, and so it evolved, and you know, large bits. So there was a huge section which was just cut actually and turned into a short diary, for example. It was initially about 90 pages and reduced to about 8 pages, that sort of thing, and so we didn't have a master plan. We didn't divide up, you do chapter one, I'll do two, you do three. That wasn't like that. It was much more improvised. And
it was, but it was so intensely improvised that it kind of, I mean, I don't want to be too sort of self-mystifying, but it kind of became its own brain, really, you know. And we thought that was true of the play as well, that you kind of scratch at the play and reveal all of this weird undergrowth that for us was the last. So we were quite critically excited at the same time as we were creatively excited, if you see what I mean. We take things from the play that suddenly seemed like, you know, the dragon's teeth to sort of spring into life in our fiction. So that was happening a lot. And we did, as Simon says, I mean, we did all of that, but we also refused things. We'd have ideas that we'd both be excited about at times, and we'd think that's brilliant. We'd go for it. We'd write loads, and then we'd think no. It did seem to start to have its own imperative. We wanted richness, which we thought was in the play, but we also wanted real directness and clarity. I hope it has.
Ewan talks as though we're sensible people a bit. At one point, we decided to narrate the whole thing through birds. Do you remember? The entire novel was going to be spoken by different birds. And we've both got a slightly dangerous osmotic capability when you can kind of become the thing you think you're becoming. And these dreadful, terrible sort of fade. Remember the birds, the multiple. I even got a book called The Best British Birds and read it. I actually read a book about British birds and looked at the qualities of birds and thought, okay, we'll have a sparrow here, an albatross. You know, this genuinely, and it was just awful reading it a little bit. You know, because we both went off and did our bird narrations and they were terrible. Remember?
I don't really remember. I think that was someone else.
Every scene had a bird in it, narrating his or her response to the action.
Well, there's a bit of it as with the Rook's Tale.
Oh, the Rook's Tale, yeah.
It's an arc, you know. I saw both of you as Macbeth, and I wonder how much of Macbeth is in either of you, or if that's not a Ben.
Well, I can assure you there's no Lady Macbeth in my life, but I...
And my wife is in the audience.
Were you rewriting key scenes quite often? I'd imagine some of the content in a way that the birds were delivering it has made its way into the final, even if the style and the form hasn't. Did you sort of naturally gravitate to finding the scenes by writing and rewriting them? Or was it sort of you'd have an attempt and then, right, we're going to ditch the birds and start from scratch and let's try a different route?
I mean, a lot of it worked like that. So you'd have something which was taken a bit too far or became, you know, the framing narrative of the bird in the attic was taken too far. But there was something there about sort of queering the perspective, which then often it was just about, shaving stuff away. But then there is something strange and a bit unexpected about the scene that remains. And so, there was a lot of paring down, enormous amount of paring down of pretty much every scene was cut a lot.
There's also early on that you'll both know that there's that strange discussion between Macbeth, a really horrible discussion between Macbeth and the murderers, where he suddenly gives a catalogue of kinds of dog. Which thickens the impasto and the mood and so forth, but sort of does nothing dramatically or is massively in excess of what it might do dramatically. And we were really fascinated by that sort of excessive, hairy sort of life in the play. And we very much wanted to discover. And I suppose we felt that the play had a mind in excess of the minds of its characters, and we wanted to kind of capture a bit of that. So with the birds and similarly with the dogs thing, which was an early scene that we worked over and labored over and polished and so forth. And in the end, it comes in, it has its moment, but as I think your question suggests, that, you know, it also there's some sort of process of synecdoche almost, that we'd write little things that weren't obviously part of the story but really mattered to us while we wrote them, and then we'd pair them away because they clearly weren't part of the story, but we would hope to transfuse some of that weirdness into the thing, that the life of the world of the plays mattered to us, and we tried to create something like it in the novel we wrote.
And did you need to sort of keep referring back to the play to see if the integrity of things you'd written sort of fitted with it, like things you had a sense of that belonged in your story, but then you needed to cross-reference with the original material? Or
personally, it wasn't so much checking back, but as, you know, I think the play was pretty inward with both of us. We both felt, you know, quite very, very knew it. But what I certainly did experience is that there'd be times when you'd, for one reason or another, not to check on, just you'd go back to the play, maybe you were teaching it or whatever, and renewing something. And something about Shakespeare's just immediacy and freshness, and just you think, geez, that's something we're getting totally burrowing into our own little creation and a little bit claustrophobic. And here's Shakespeare with it, and the clarity. Not that it's all clear, lots of it's dense and difficult, but the emotional immediacy of Shakespeare was a constant reminder. And then certain things, like, you know, we're doing all this stuff about temptation or whatever, but then how are we dealing with just the fundamental feeling of guilt, mm-hmm. or the fundamental feeling of being stuck in something that all you can do now is repeat that idea? So it's really simple things which would then come, and then alternatively there'd be little moments which seemed less central to the play's really foundational emotions, but little moments which people never notice, which we would just one of us would just harp upon. So I had to remember that bit, a tiny little bit where obiter dicta, as it were, which we then just trope on. You know, that was another way it happened, where you get something which has been disregarded and you just kind of bring it back into action. That was also happening quite a lot.
In terms of the vocabulary that you were using, I mean, Shakespeare has a sort of distinct style of Macbeth, and someone has its own sort of distinct texture to the vocabulary and the way the words are put together, there's echoes of that in Macbeth, but you're not trying to sort of ape Shakespearean language per se. But was there a lot of conscious thought in terms of picking the vocabulary, or did you feel you'd sort of imbued Macbeth enough and you had the ideas that you were looking to explore that you just put the words down on the page and they came out the way they came out?
Bit of both, really. I mean, it was very internalized, and as Simon said, we'd have, it was the best kind of, it was a really fantastic sort of literary critical experience, because we suddenly it would reproduce the play in particular phrases and so on, and we'd work with the phrase. But we did, recollecting correctly, I mean, it was kind of more based upon, it borrowed more from Shakespeare, and then we actually found that we had to pare that away, really, that it needed to have its own life and idiom, and of course it also needed to be kind of true to the present, even though it was strangely at odds with it, really. So I mean, and we also had loads of other stuff we were throwing onto the easel, really. From there was a, it's suddenly Macbeth seemed a kind of an invitation to absolutely everything, really, and everyone we'd read and so forth. And there was a kind of improvised, you know, quality to that. And when Simon and I met recently, we were talking about what we were each reading and, you know, how that might have coloured things slightly differently. You know, the things we're reading now are not the things we were reading then. But there are lots of other voices. I'm sure you picked up loads of things, but, you know, there's loads of other voices in there. And maybe there's something interesting about that. So the bits of Yeats that are somehow close to Macbeth, but, you know, so we bring into, pull things into the texture and maybe strike strange lights. I'd like to think so.
We didn't want to do pastiche. We just didn't. We really didn't want to do pastiche. And as Ewan said, we there are still small moments of quotation from the play, but not that many, and we cut a lot of those away because they felt a bit gauche or knowing or something. The language of the play, in a way, it was just written. This might seem a bizarre thing to say, but it was just written straight. You know, you just try and write it straight, and this is what came out. You know, and as you say, but you know, you've imbued it all, and so it might not be that you're imitating the language so much as sort of getting inside a metaphor. There'd be a particular metaphor, and you almost literally get inside it, and getting inside that metaphor furnishes a scene, and that scene is the thing that's your way of entering the language, and it might be a room, or it might be a wood, or it might be a tree, or it might be anything. It might be a bowl of soup. You know, you're just inside it, a wound. You know, that was a big one for us, wasn't it? The wounds of possibility, which is kind of typical, because that's an example. So it comes from right at the start of the play, my gaseous cry for help, the soldier says, sort of personifying the gash, the wound, and giving it a voice. I mean, that was really important. But then that linked with Kierkegaard's notion of the wounds of possibility, which is a really sort of a thing, which was an idea, I mean, Ewan became one too, a big fan of Kierkegaard. And so just melding those two together and then create scenes or that begins to furnish an actual body of a character. So
it's true. I mean, sometimes there was the thing that's coming to my mind, I mean, it could be almost a banal thing. So there are these, almost every phrase in Macbeth is sort of incredibly alive. So, you know, violent grief becomes a modern ecstasy and so on. What does that mean? And we'd spend a lot of time in those sorts of moments. But actually, I was thinking, Simon, the timely inn, which is not a, you know, it's a thoroughly, thoroughly banal notion, really. I mean, well, here's the timely inn. Let's go in and have a drink or have something to eat.
Then we'd say it's a quantum inn. We'd start mucking around. What does it mean to be a timely inn? Does time actually describe the inn? And then you think, oh, Christ, that's weird. This is kind of this quantum inn which keeps on moving through space and, you know, whatever, you know.
Which, yeah, so it becomes an uncanny thing.
Yeah.
But I do also think that there was just, in the kind of vertigo of, you know, let's take on Macbeth. I mean, we were aware of that as kind of ludicrously hubristic in a sense, but on the other hand, very democratic, because anyone who reads the play has to kind of do that. And then two minds and you know, all the rest of it. But this is going back to a previous questions of yours, really, but the Jamie, I think what you said about going back to the play did provide a kind of break as well. So it was both permission to do all sorts of new things and imagine new things. But we were very aware that we needed to discipline all of this because, you know, part of the pleasure was sort of vertiginous leaps of imagination. And of course, working with someone else where the imagination, not your own, is doing all sorts of extraordinary things. And we also wanted to bring it home. And actually the play, for all that, of course, it's an unreachable, you know, thing, was also something to rein us in a bit, that Simon used to talk about it as a
wearing a harness on her back, which is itself something Beth says. At least we'll die with harness on her back. And so I said we've got to wear the play like a harness on her back. And then I stopped thinking that.
Yeah, but I do think it helped to get, it gave us a kind of through line.
In terms of the practicalities of working together, did you? I presume a lot of it was done online. Did you have a single document that everything was going into? Were you sort of sending disparate emails with bits of text here and there, or did you have a way of combining and coalescing everything, or did that only happen later on?
We didn't have a master document or anything, did we? It wasn't very controlled like that.
We were too technologically lazy as well. We didn't, even if there had been Google interactive docs, we wouldn't have bothered to learn it. It depended on the constant kind of exposure to each other and a kind of living conversation. We did do loads of stuff in email and then we'd wrap things up and we worked very, very fast and furiously on it. And we somehow had more time than anyone deserves, even though we weren't doing the jobs properly.
Was there, and I don't want to sort of raise anything that might be sensitive here regarding your friendship, but was there any point at which anyone, either of you went drastically off-piste in the opinion of the other, and you needed to say, look, it can't just be birds talking to each other in play form? Or was it, could you always get a sense that you could explain? I'm just interested in the practicalities of obviously two people working on it.
In the whole time, we never had an argument, did we? We never had a disagreement. We never had a kind of bad-tempered word, not one. There were lots of times when you think, no, hang on a second.
This is just a bit much.
And so, you know, but it was just, you're completely frank about it and say, well, I think we just got to pare this down a bit. And you've got the sort of strangeness or the weirdness or the extremity of it, but it doesn't need to be kind of labored over for a whole paragraph. Let's just cut. So that happened a lot.
And conversely, did you have, you'd written something and thought, this is bloody brilliant, and send it across and got a less than enthusiastic response?
Yes, no. I think the miracle of it really was that we just seemed to have so much energy and time for it that you kill your darlings, don't you, all the time, or it really is no good. And we did do that, and there were times where I had something that I loved and it ends up in the slop bucket or whatever. But I think we did it so much that we just knew that was necessary. Maybe another thing, I don't know what you think, Simon, but I think there was enough in common really that any error was sort of shared in a way, no matter whose it was. So we gave permission for each other to really try new things. And so the venturesomeness, suppose I felt if I'd done something that we actually thought, no, it's not, I would tend to agree in the end. And I think we kind of rewarded each other for the venturesomeness as well, if you see what I mean, even if you lost it. I remember us saying that the things we excluded, and I don't think we were just, I mean, it's a very strategic thing to say, but I don't think we were being strategic, that the things we excluded were contributions to the shared book. I know that you remember that, Simon, but that seemed to me quite a powerful point.
It sounds as though the editing process was kind of baked into the writing process then, to an extent that you were just sort of drafting, redrafting, taking ideas, reformulating them. Was there a point when you kind of reached draft one and you said, okay, this is the book exists now and here's a draft, and you then went back to a more sort of formal editing process? Or
the first time we arrived at what we thought was a finished book, it was about 140,000 words. We thought it was done, and then as I said before, it almost got taken by a really good publisher and then didn't. And then I think that was a bit of a setback for us, and we had a little loss of energy, and we both engaged heavily in other projects, and then we came back to it a couple of years later, and at that stage that was a more formal thing, and I remember I felt very strongly it was just simply too long and that we needed to cut it. So I mean, I think the most that ever happened is when I remember I took the thing and thought, this is pursuant to all sorts of conversations between you and I, saying I think we should try this and cut this scene and reduce that and whatever. You know, we're talking a lot about how we might make the whole thing, make the narrative more, a little bit more Arrow-like or something, but more direct. And I remember then, at that stage, then pursuant to these conversations, spending some time doing that, quite a big edit that I remember doing, and then showing Ewan and Ewan being, you know, happy with it. That was the only time, and that was a sort of a not even penultimate. It was like a pre-penultimate edit when we sort of got a shape for the final thing, which then we went back to our normal way of everything. But that was the closest, because it was quite a radical cut of 50,000 words, which is huge. But we also completely changed the book, really. I don't even remember all the stuff we cut now, but
we cut an enormous amount. You know, when you're doing that sort of thing, you, and it's with a collaboration, and especially in our world where there's sort of essentially a maybe necessary but also somewhat untenable system of credit and so forth, and you can think, oh well, that's, you know, all that bit's gone and that's my bit or whatever. But it didn't, again, it was never really like that. I think because we'd lived it so intensely, the things that you cut have their own life in the collaboration, and in maybe even as lacunae or something, even in the finished thing. But I don't know. I mean, I suppose because it's an unusual book, and it certainly wasn't a sensible thing for two professors to do, sort of thing. And in a sense, it's never, we'd like it to have a larger audience, to be read by more people and so forth. But maybe the fact that it hasn't as yet had that sort of exposure means that it's still alive. It still has a bit of germinal life or something. So I don't think of it in a strange way. I don't think of it as finished. Actually, I now realize as we talk, although it is a finished thing.
Ewan's contemplating the very Aurum edition of the Macbeth, which would include all the.
I'm not.
All the discarded pieces.
Bring the birds back. I'm not.
Leading on from that, is there? Would you work together on any future projects? Have you got plans afoot to do anything around Macbeth or around any other topics?
Well, we did some stuff after this with the Fairy Queen. Not after, sort of during the same period, we did a big collaboration on the Fairy Queen, yeah. which was different. Wasn't a novel. It was, I did a theatre and film project, and Ewan did a liturgy project. But then we in the last few years, we've been doing slightly different things, which is a bit of a shame in some ways. So we haven't got any plans at the moment.
Yeah, we have been doing different things. But in a sense, maybe that was necessary because the collaboration was so intense and so close. And I think, you know, in a way you've got to kind of move into separate domains of mind or something in order, and we still talk. And certainly we could do, I feel, you know, that is the conversation would allow it.
Do you feel there's anything, I mean, you might say it goes for quite a lot of Shakespeare, but is there anything else that you feel would be really crying out for this approach, the very sort of specific way that you approach Macbeth, that you think there's a blindingly obvious other work that you could apply it to?
The one that I'm interested in at the moment is Comedy of Errors, actually, because it's a very strange, it's a very, very weird sort of metaphysical farce, which is all about counterparts and, you know, when your life is being lived by another and you know, this sort of stuff. And I see it as Shakespeare's kind of auto-fiction, you know, his most sustained dramatizing of a marriage, for example, things like that. I think that's really, really interesting. And it would be interesting to work with farce, I think. And farce is the most serious a way of diagramming human consequentiality or something. I think that would be interesting. How we do it, and I don't have no idea, but that's the one I think would be good to work with. It's got a sort of geometrical quality I like.
Yeah, it also has more space in it than Macbeth in some way, so, or for obvious reasons. But yeah, and I think comedy is it. I mean, I'm doing a sort of comedy project with Birmingham Rep at the moment, who want to reinvent themselves as the sort of national comedy theatre. There isn't one, and the artistic director there, Sean Foley, he's interesting, and he thinks that, you know, just by putting comedy, the comedy mask forward, you know, that you could just change everything really in English culture in particular. So there might be some context for that sort of thing. But I mean, I do think there was something a bit fated about Macbeth, I mean, obviously, but about Macbeth, and it was an amazing occasion for what we enjoyed doing, you know, so it'd be hard to beat that.
Have you seen the play performed since working on it, or during working on it? Has it changed your sort of visceral experience of watching the play?
It just generates resentment, basic resentment. I've seen it a couple. I saw the Patrick Stewart one. Did you see that, Ewan? I can't remember.
Yeah, I did see it, yeah.
Which is all right. I didn't love it. I mean, I actively dislike most theatre in England. I really do. I can't stand it. I think the English ruin it with their stupid accents and their. But it's changing a bit. And actually, it's quite interesting that there's quite a lot of. There's absolutely no influence here on our part, but there's so much more in the way of adaptation now. It's almost the go-to thing to do when people start dealing with Shakespeare now, as they adapt it. They turn symbol into Imogen or whatever. You know, these sorts of things are happening all over the place, and, you know, Emma Rice's version of whatever it is.
Would you be open to an adaptation, a stage production of Macbeth?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's perfect for that. I mean, and it's just something we've never had the time to do, but I think it's extremely. I don't know. We did have a project for a little while about adapting for the stage, didn't we? But then we decided that it was a bit too unruly. It would be better on film. But
yeah, I think film.
But that takes so much time and money, and, you know, but I think it would be, I think it would work if we could find the right. But, you know, it's just such a lottery, that whole world.
I mean, yeah, just to add another thing there is that foreign language Shakespeare tends to be much more like Macbeth than English language Shakespeare, for obvious reasons. So German Shakespeare isn't very free and experimental, and you know, the kind of conversation is with modern thinkers as much as it is with, you know, early modern.
So, Simon, just out of interest, your objection to the accents, do you mean the kind of the sort of formal stuffiness of Shakespeare in Britain, or?
Yeah, it's going away a little bit, but I just find that I still think it's there. I think there's the way in which you the English appropriate Shakespeare. I think they own Shakespeare, and they align it with particular forms of accent. And so, you know, just the obvious ones like this. I really hated that the Hollow Crown. A lot of people liked it. Richard II and so forth on television with what's his name, curly headed pretty guy, playing Richard, and Simon Russell Beale playing Falstaff. You know, I hated it because it just seemed to like it was just like watching the bloody funeral of Queen Elizabeth. You know, just this awful. This kind of deadening conformity of the whole thing, and just this kind of reinstitution of all the forms of hierarchy and the kind of pride in that, it just makes me angry. And, you know, and I hear it at Oxford. I mean, I don't like everything about Oxford, and one of the things I really don't like is when they have this really nice arts festival, which is a great thing, an arts festival. It's fantastic. The students get all involved, but it's a little bit annoying when they do every year they. Oh, every second year that it was Shakespeare play, and all the fruity voices come up to my office. You know, the fruity. I don't mean fruity in the sense of camp. I mean fruity in the sense of, you know, the sort of accent you've got to put on to do Shakespeare. And I think it just kills it for a lot of people. And they, you know, and it's not just the automatic association of BBC accents with the main characters, and then the yokels can do the clowns. It's not just that. There's just something about the whole thing which is claimed by a particular class system. And that gets reinforced, by the way, nowadays, most actors who went to Eton, you know, and this sort of thing. I just think it's just the whole thing is a bit classist, and I find that annoying. And the only way to, and then you can resist that, as people like Emma Rice does, but she didn't last long at the Globe, did she? She does her own thing, and you know, good on her. But it's just a bit intemperate on my part.
There is a problem at the moment with the arts really being. Taken over sounds bad, but I think whenever there's a new, say a British actor who I suddenly will notice on TV or in a film or something, and I'll just go on Wikipedia and have a look, I would just now put money on them having been privately educated.
You know, and that's just getting worse. And I mean, it's, and they're great actors. There's not decrying these actors. They're often extremely talented, but I mean, they always are. But I mean, the opportunities, and you can only get into drama school if you can pay for all the fees. That's a 2 or 3 year thing, you know. It's just the whole thing is weighted against anyone who's not got private wealth.
Do you know what the situation was in Shakespeare's time? Not expert, but were the players, the actors, were they predominantly privately educated or not, or was it a mix?
The theatre wasn't full of upmarket people at all. I mean, most of the playwrights were university educated. Most of the public playwrights, Shakespeare was an exception. Ben Jonson was another exception. Most of them went to Oxford or Cambridge, but the players didn't. Most of them they went to school, you know, and they would have been to school, and they would have learned the basics of rhetoric and so forth. You know, they've done the basic rhetorical training, obviously, and so forth. But no, they weren't at all.
They're still a bit disreputable.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah. they were, and but you know, but then they threw the. I mean, the main wealth that the players had was in their costumes. Mm. They used to get lots of costumes from dead nobility, and so they would often go through the streets in their finery and you know, like actors to show offs, you know. So they would do that, but it was nothing like all the guys today who go into theatre wouldn't have gone anywhere near the theatre back then. They'd have gone to the plays like John Donne, but they'd be the Inns of Court writing poems for patrons.
Okay, and thank you to Simon and Ewan for joining us, and thank you for listening.
You can find more about Unsigned Methods and listen back to our 5-year back catalogue at unsignedmethods.co.uk or in any of the usual podcast places. You can find us on Twitter at Unsigned Methods, or you can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com, or I'm on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
And you can find out about me and my writing at jamiebatchin.com, on Twitter at jamiebatchin, and on Instagram at jamie_batchin. Thank you again for joining us. Hopefully another fruitful 5 years lies ahead. I hope it's helped your writing, listening to us and other writers witching on about the whole process. And forward to plenty more.